Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Hello everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors episode 43. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. As always, I'd like to begin by thanking the wonderful patrons who continue to support this podcast. I'm so very grateful for your encouragement and generosity. A full list of patrons is available on my website under the Patrons tab. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. August's prize is a gift voucher for Claire Ridgway's wonderful The Life of Anne Boleyn online course, valued at $75. There's no start or end date, so it can be done at your own pace from the comfort of your own home. A huge thank you to Claire for donating this fabulous prize. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about the Grey Sisters is Leander de Lisle. Leander took a master's degree in history at Oxford University and went into journalism, where she became a leading columnist on The Spectator magazine, The Guardian newspaper, Country Life magazine, and The Daily Express. She continues to write regularly for The Times and has published several critically acclaimed books on Tudor and Stuart history. Her first book, After Elizabeth, was runner-up for the Saltire First Book Award. Her second, The Sisters Who Would Be Queen, was a New York Times Top 10 bestseller. Her third, Tudor, The Family Story, was a Sunday Times Top 10 bestseller. And her latest book, White King, won the Historical Writers Association Nonfiction Crown. My conversation with Leander straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Leander. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
And it's lovely to have you on the show. I thought we could just begin by you just introducing yourself to our listeners and telling us a little bit about your background, please.
Okay. My name is Leander de Lisle, which sounds as if it's been made up. I sound like a romantic novelist or possibly a porn star, but actually I was born Leander Dormer and I married a man called de Lisle, and so I ended up with this weird Leander de Lisle as my name. I read history at Oxford. I became a journalist. I was a journalist for a number of years. I was a columnist on some very varied publications, from the Guardian newspaper to the Spectator magazine to Country Life. I mean, all sorts of things, you name it. I read history, and then I returned to that after a number of years in journalism, and I began with a book on the death of Elizabeth I and the accession of King James. And I've been writing books on Tudor and Stuart history ever since. My latest book is a book on Charles I called White King, The Tragedy of Charles I. And I was very pleased that it won a prize this year, the Historical Writers Association Nonfiction Crown. So that was very pleasing. So that's me, pretty much.
Wonderful, and congratulations. That's a fantastic thing to happen to your book. Wonderful. Now, I'd love to talk a little bit about The Sisters Who Would Be Queen, which is another one of your wonderful history books. Could you tell us a little bit about that one?
Yes. Well, when I was writing this book on the death of Elizabeth, I discovered that it hadn't actually been a straightforward Elizabeth dies, James I, King of Scots, the Stuart King, followed in her footsteps. And that, in fact, he wasn't her heir in English law. Her heir in English law was a descendant of this girl called Lady Catherine Grey, who was a sister of the famous 9 days queen, Lady Jane Grey. So I thought, oh, well, that's very interesting. So I thought I'd look into that. I discovered, first of all, that almost everything that had been written about Jane appeared to be a lie, and that nobody really had said much about these two extraordinary sisters of hers, the second sister, Catherine, being the mother of the heirs to the throne.
Okay, fantastic. So you became sort of drawn to their story while you were writing your other book. Can you tell us a little bit about their actual upbringing and their family?
Yes, they were the daughters of Henry VIII's niece, Lady Frances Brandon. And they were brought up partly at court, partly at Bradgate Park in Leicestershire. And they had a rather extraordinary upbringing. They were highly, well, the two eldest ones particularly Jane, was highly educated.
Yes.
And they were the first generation really to be raised as what we would now term Protestants. The what became even more, I suppose, unusual about that upbringing was when Henry VIII died, he rewrote his will to make them the Longstop heirs to his daughter Elizabeth Tudor, the daughter of Anne Boleyn and the future Elizabeth I.
And so Jane, Leander, Jane is often portrayed as a bit of a shrinking violet, you know, very different to, I suppose, the determined young woman, which I believe you discovered in your research. So could you tell us a little bit more about the kind of woman or young lady that Jane was?
Yes, as I mentioned, she was very highly educated and she was also extremely bright. She spoke a number of languages, including French, Italian, Spanish. She did Latin, Greek, and even Hebrew.
Wow.
She was extremely clever girl and quite sort of passionate. She was very passionate about her religious beliefs, in the same way that many teenagers today are maybe passionate environmentalists, say.
Yes.
She had those sorts of beliefs. She was, you know, convinced that this was the answer to life's great questions, and responded with all the passion of a teenager. One of her tutors actually wrote to a friend of his on the continent asking how he should go about bridling a restive horse, and that's how he saw her. She was, you know, she was someone who, once she got the bit between her teeth, was extremely determined.
Wow, very different to the kind of portrayal of her as this kind of weak, submissive girl that we often see even now. It's really interesting.
Yes, there's something almost sort of creepy about that. There's a very famous picture by a French artist called François Delaroche in the National Gallery in England of Jane on the scaffold dressed in white. And she's depicted almost as a kind of virgin sacrifice. And there's something distinctly sort of erotic about the picture. You know, this very vulnerable girl who's about to be cut to pieces. And I came across actually a quite extraordinary letter from the writer Nancy Mitford to Evelyn Waugh, in which she claimed that, you know, all her own adolescent sexual fantasies were around this picture, which I think says a lot about it.
Gosh, never heard that one before, that's for sure.
And there's lots of my book people won't have read before.
You mentioned, obviously, her reign was a very brief reign, and we have that, you know, the 9-day queen sort of thing. But after her brief reign, she's imprisoned for about 6 months, is that right, before she's executed?
Yes, she's imprisoned for longer than that, but in the Tower, yes, okay. Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. So she's in the Tower for, you know, like 6 months, roughly 6 months. Do we know how she spent her time? Are there any records about what she did, whether she had any visitors, what sort of liberties she had?
Yes, they sort of changed over time, but there's a description of her, for example, being part of a kind of supper party in the little house of the lieutenant of the Tower, and visitors to the Tower coming in, and they see her and they meet her. She's also, after a period of time, given permission to walk around on some of the sort of roof of the Tower. But otherwise, I think she spent a lot of time reading and writing, you know, thinking. I think she was very much a political animal, so she was extremely involved in what was happening outside the Tower, and the tremendous changes that were taking place under Mary Tudor, the incoming queen.
Yes, and you mentioned the writing. I wanted to talk to you about some of those letters that she wrote from the Tower. They're quite, I suppose, controversial, considering that Mary was on the throne, and quite damning in the end for her, opposing Mary's religious legislation. Can you talk to us a little bit about those?
Yes. Well, in December of 1553, Mary Tudor reintroduces, but gives permission again for the Catholic Mass to be said in England. And Jane strongly opposes this. And she writes a sort of open letter that is a sort of public letter to a former tutor of hers who's converted to Catholicism, describing him as a sort of imp of the devil, and his soul, I think, is the stinking kennel of Satan. And she says that people must oppose this reintroduction of the Mass, and that they should remember that Christ came to bring the sword, and so they must oppose it. And she compares the Mass to a kind of form of satanic cannibalism. So she's not sitting on her hands sort of just being sweet.
No, it's quite amazing considering, you know, she's imprisoned basically alive because Mary hasn't had her executed yet. And
the plan was for her to be pardoned, but yes. But Jane wants to make a stand against this, which she regards as something wicked.
Yeah, goodness, what courage! All right, so I've also read that I think it was the day of the execution or the day before that her husband, which was also imprisoned at the Tower at the time, Guildford Dudley, wanted to meet her. He wanted to see her for one last time. Is that correct? Have you seen evidence for that?
That comes from an Italian report, so we don't know whether it's true. I mean, the thing is with Jane, there's so much untruth written about her at the time as well as later, that unless a detail is absolutely nailed down, we know for a fact it's true, and it's preferably got Jane's own signature on it, then I'm suspicious. So you have this image of her, of, you know, Guildford saying, "Oh, I'd love to see you for one last time," and her saying, no, I must spend my time in prayer. It gives a sort of very sort of Italian view of a sort of romantic and passionate young man and a sort of pious and chaste woman. And it could be true. I mean, it's not impossible, but I think we can't be certain. It wasn't made up. There were a lot of rumours and stories flying around. I would say that I looked very carefully into Jane's relationship with Guildford, and everything that she actually wrote or said, as opposed to those things that she was supposed to have written or said, suggested that she respected her husband. There's no evidence that he maltreated her, direct evidence that he maltreated her, as some would have it.
Now, her sisters, Catherine and Mary, they survived their sister's downfall. So what was life like for them after Jane's, you know, extended imprisonment and then her execution? Where were they when all this was going on?
Well, they were at home for certainly part of it with their mother, because their father was also executed. But Mary forgave the family and invited Catherine and little Mary Grey, back to court. So they were serving Mary Tudor at court, which must have been quite extraordinary, essentially serving the woman who had ordered the execution of your sister and your father. But they did. Catherine was herself, you know, an educated girl. She was only sort of 13, 12 or 13 at this stage, but she had already started learning Latin and Greek. But I think she was more interested, perhaps because, you know, she had seen her sister die, and despite the fact her sister had written her a final letter saying that she too must make a stand against Queen Mary and Catholicism and die for her faith. I think Catherine just wanted to live life, fall in love, have children. That's what Catherine wanted to do. And indeed, she did fall in love very dangerously.
Yes, yeah, I was just going to ask you about that because I know there's a bit of controversy with her as well, isn't there?
Oh, a great deal, because as I said, in English law, under English statute and under the will of Henry VIII, Lady Catherine Grey was the heir of Elizabeth Tudor. It was not Mary, Queen of Scots, as people believe. Anyway, so she met and was falling in love at the time Mary Tudor died with a young man called Ned Seymour, Earl of Hertford, who was the son of Edward VI's uncle, the Protector Somerset. So he had impeccably Protestant credentials. He had some royal blood. He had royal connections. He was really the sort of perfect groom for an English Protestant princess. And for this reason, when Mary died and Elizabeth became queen, she posed a great threat to Elizabeth. Elizabeth, the Virgin Queen, never married. She never married. She never had heirs. And she was well aware that she was at constant risk of being overthrown, not only by Catholics, but also by her own Protestant supporters, who believed very strongly that they should have a king rather than a queen on the throne and wanted one that was going to produce a male heir. So she was desperate that that Catherine not marry. But Catherine and Ned did marry in secret. Mm. And it was an extremely passionate marriage. And we have lots of very rare and extremely intimate descriptions of their lovemaking, including on their wedding night.
Right.
Sides of the bed they slept on and, you know, what she wore or didn't wear. And so forth, and the letters she wrote to him. But eventually she became pregnant, and so Elizabeth found out about the marriage and threw her and Ned into the Tower. She couldn't stop Catherine's son being born, but because the marriage had been held in secret, Elizabeth managed to have the child declared a bastard, illegitimate. But then the problem was that Catherine and Ned had a lot of sympathisers in the Tower, and somebody left their cell doors unlocked. So there was literally sort of corridor creeping going on in the Tower. And again, we have detailed descriptions of exactly what took place. And Catherine became pregnant again. I mean, it's almost unbelievable.
That is unbelievable. Gosh.
Yeah. And produced a second son in the Tower, at which point Elizabeth sort of went mad with rage. She threw the lieutenant of the Tower into prison, in one of his own cells, and Catherine and Ned were separated and held in separate country houses, where Catherine eventually fell into a sort of, you know, deep depression, because she was separated not only from her husband but also from her elder son. And there's a portrait of her with her baby, famous portrait, and it's actually the first picture of a mother and child that isn't the Virgin and child in English art.
Right, okay, that's fascinating. Wow, another tragic story for the Grey family, isn't that?
It does end tragically, because she eventually dies, and it's really of a sort of broken heart, really. She stops eating, and she falls ill, and her jailer, who fascinantly I discovered was a descendant in the illegitimate line from Owen Tudor, who founded the whole dynasty right back in the 15th century. But anyway, he was her jailer, and he writes to court saying, you know, it's possible she could live, but she doesn't want to live. And so she dies, and she asks one of her last, she begs Elizabeth in her sort of last words to look after her children and to be kind to her husband. And she sends her husband a ring, a Memento Mori ring, with the words written on it, "While I lived, yours," which I think is very touching.
And so what happened to the husband?
He was kept in prison for several more years, and then he was released. Again, there's so many extraordinary aspects to this story. He lived well into until almost the end of the reign of James I. And shortly after he died, his grandson built him an incredible tomb in Salisbury Cathedral to his grandfather. And he had his grandmother, Lady Catherine Grey, disinterred from where she'd been buried, where she'd been imprisoned in Suffolk, and brought down and put in this amazing tomb, which sort of celebrates the lovers reunited at last. And they indeed discovered the priest who had originally married them as well, so to prove that they had in fact married.
Well, what a lovely gesture, yeah. And what about Mary? Does she have a happier end?
Yes, up to a point. She is the survivor, Lady Mary Grey. She's a fantastic character, Lady Mary Grey. She has what I believe she's described as crook-backed and very ugly by the Spanish diplomat at court. Poor Mary was, but this didn't stop someone falling in love with her. We'll come to that. I think she had scoliosis, which is, you know, curvature of the spine, which I suspect she'd inherited through the Plantagenets. Now, Richard III very famously had scoliosis. Less well known is the fact that Edward VI, Henry VIII's son, also had scoliosis. And anyway, I think that's what Mary had. While Catherine was already in prison, she met and fell in love with she was the smallest person at court, and she fell in love with the biggest person at court, who was the head of sort of palace security, a man called Thomas Keyes. It was a giant of a man. So you had the supposed sort of dwarf marrying a giant, which she also did in secret. She didn't dare tell Elizabeth. Now, this marriage did not really pose any threat to Elizabeth, because Thomas Keyes was a commoner. He wasn't royal. He wasn't a sort of smarty pants figure like Ned Seymour. But nevertheless, I think, you know, she wanted to show how angry she was that Mary had married without her permission. And so Mary was imprisoned. At Chequers, for example, where Chequers is one of the places where she was imprisoned, which is, you know, now the Prime Minister's country residence. And they have letters she wrote, you know, pleading with Elizabeth to let her out. And poor old Thomas Keyes was stuffed into a very small cell in the Fleet Prison. And eventually he was released, and he asked for Mary to be allowed to join him. And she was refused permission to do this, and Thomas Keyes died. Mary was obviously very angry about this little Mary Grey, and she had a picture painted of herself, a portrait painted of herself at this stage, in which she's showing off her wedding ring to the viewer, holding her hand forward. And she has flowers in her hair, which are symbols of love and memory for her husband. As her husband's dead, Elizabeth eventually, a few years later, releases her. And so Mary even goes back to court, and there's descriptions of her going back to court. She lives a modest life in a house in the shadow of the tower, where, of course, her sister died. And she helps raise... Her husband was obviously a widower when she married him, and she raises his daughter. And so she dies eventually a free woman, possibly of plague. And no one knew where she was buried, but I managed to find a manuscript describing her funeral. And so we now know that she was in fact buried in her mother's tomb in Westminster Abbey. And there she lies, you know, surrounded by all her royal ancestors, all the kings and queens of England from whom she was descended.
Wow, what a fabulous find. That's amazing.
Yes, no, and what's rather wonderful, some of the details, it's very interesting to see who is at the funeral. For example, one of the people at the funeral is the jailer who was with Catherine Grey when she died, the man who was descended from Owen Tudor. He is at the funeral. You also have one of the women, the ladies-in-waiting who attended on Jane on the scaffold. She is also at Mary's funeral. And so it ties the whole story together, really. It's an extraordinary document.
Yes, it's those connections that I absolutely love, when you make one of those connections and you think, oh my goodness, like, you know, you didn't know it before. It's so wonderful.
It helps brings it alive, I think, you know, that these were all human beings. I think that's the important thing with these people is that they are human. They're like you and I. Their circumstances are different, but they're people just like you and I.
That's so true. And when you were talking about the marriages that they had, I was thinking, did they not know how much Elizabeth hated secret marriages?
Yes, but again, I mean, I think, you know, they were in love. Were in love. And, you know, people do all sorts of foolish things for love all the time. I'm sure we can think of foolish things we've done ourselves, foolish things our friends have done, you know, risks we've taken, risks they've taken. It's life.
And you know, Leander, I really love walking in the footsteps of the Tudors. Like you say, you know, they were real people like you and I. And I think it's hammered home when you're standing in a spot where they once stood, where they walked, where they laughed, where they cried. What's one of your favourite historic sites to visit that has a connection to one of the Grey sisters?
Gosh, I think Salisbury Cathedral, which obviously attracted, I don't even remember, the attention of those Russian KGB agents who weren't at all going to sort of poison somebody with Novichok, but claimed that they were keen to visit Salisbury Cathedral. So maybe they had an interest in Lady Catherine Grey and Ned Seymour, I don't know.
Maybe.
But, but they didn't look like the kind of people who would be interested in them. But certainly that's well worth visiting. I mean, Westminster Abbey, I mean, you know, again. And one of the, you must, I think, go to the museum at Westminster Abbey and see, you can see the effigies. You can see Mary Tudor's effigy that lay on her tomb. All sorts of fascinating things. You can see this incredible ring that supposedly belonged to Elizabeth and the Earl of Essex, her last favourite. Fascinating things you can see.
You mentioned earlier that there are many untruths when it comes to Lady Jane Grey, I think in particular, but possibly all the Grey sisters. What do you think is one of the, you know, the a misconception that's just persisted and persisted? What's one of those that you'd like to clarify right now, Leander?
Well, I think, I suppose, something which would apply to all of them is the myth that their mother, Frances, was some kind of monster, horrible mother. There's a famous portrait of this sort of rather heavy woman with a young man, which has always been said was for a long time, actually since the 18th century, was said to have been Frances and her second husband, who was supposed to be a sort of, you know, toy boy called Adrian Stokes. And in fact, it isn't of her, it's of Lady Dacre. But people made a lot of it and said, "Ooh, look, she looks like Henry VIII, you know, poor woman's just sort of slightly overweight, you know." But anyway, and that certainly wasn't true of Frances, who, if you see her tomb at Westminster Abbey, you can see was actually a slim woman. And this myth of the cruelty of Frances was invented after Jane's execution for a sort of host of reasons, but really it became a sort of way of highlighting a Jane's supposed sweetness and innocence. And so you have Frances becomes like the wicked queen in Snow White, and Jane is the sort of vulnerable Snow White figure. It's really a sort of sexist, misogynist myth. And in fact, I prove it's simply untrue, not based in truth. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, her husband was, I think, 2 years younger than her, so hardly a toy boy.
All right. Now, are you working on any new books at the moment?
Yes, I'm really enjoying it. I'm working on a book on Charles I's wife, Henrietta Maria, who's another woman who has been sort of done down by history and about whom there's a great many myths and untruths. And I have to say, I'm really enjoying it. I mean, there's so much fantastic material. I mean, her life was so extraordinary, and her relations with everybody were so extraordinary. Her mother was so extraordinary, another amazing woman, actually. So I'm enjoying myself doing that, but it will take a while. I take quite a long time over my books, I'm afraid.
I look forward to that one too. Now, Leander, I don't know if you've listened to any other episodes, but we always like to end by playing a little game that I call 10 to Go, which is just 10 kind of, you know, random questions to get to know you a little bit better. So are you ready for that?
Oh, my Lord. Okay.
Oh, it's nothing scary. Can you name a favourite or an inspirational place close to home for you that you like to visit?
Bradgate Park, which is very close to me here. It's absolutely beautiful. If anyone's in the Midlands, you know, I urge you to go and visit it. It's the most beautiful park. It's extraordinary looking. It's incredibly wild and romantic. They've got an excellent visitor center there, which has won endless prizes. You'll love it.
Yes, and that was childhood home of Lady Jane Grey, was it not? The family?
Right. Yes, so sorry. Yes, it was the childhood home of Lady Jane Grey, and the ruins of the house are there. And it is a very, very romantic spot. It'll bring it all alive for you.
What's favorite comfort food for you?
Gosh, I have so many. I'm such a greedy pig. I love a Vietnamese chicken pho, a kind of chicken soup, believe it or not, which is, yeah, I think chicken soup is always a good comfort food, isn't it? And this Vietnamese version is particularly delicious. I'm happy to have it for breakfast when I've been in Vietnam, or for lunch if I'm in England.
Yum, sounds good. Now, here's a question I haven't asked any of my guests yet. This is a brand new question. Do you believe in past lives?
Do I believe in past lives? I'm sort of, I would say no, because it'd be so frustrating if you had a pastime. What we go on making the same stupid mistakes again and again, and I not learn anything from my past life. And I'm also suspicious, because I think people, when they say they've had a past life, they always seem to be somebody really interesting rather than somebody.
Yes.
So I would say on the whole, no. But I don't believe in past lives, but I do believe, as Shakespeare wrote, that there's more in heaven and earth than is dreamt of in our philosophy.
That's one of my favourite quotes, that one. I absolutely love that one. So excellent.
I think there's more than one can understand in the universe.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you. Now, what was the last book that you bought?
The last book I bought is an enormous fat novel called Lonesome Dove. Which is a Western, Pulitzer Prize winning Western. You're thinking, why did I buy a Western? I bought it actually. I was having dinner with a friend of mine called Robbie Millen, who's the literary editor of the Times, and he always recommends really excellent books. He recommended a novel called North Water, which, by the way, if you haven't got a strong stomach, I wouldn't recommend, but it is a fantastically exciting read, and the North Water. And I really enjoyed that. And he said, oh, you must read Lonesome Dove. So I bought it, and I'm currently reading and completely immersed in this world.
Fantastic. That sounds like something different to the usual things you're probably reading. That's great.
A history book, my gosh. I buy history books the whole time. I bought one actually yesterday on sort of gender in the early modern period. I can't actually remember the title off the top of my head, but I mean, I do that kind of every day. I mean, whereas novels I don't buy so often, because I spend so much time reading non-fiction that often in the evenings, you know, I'll just collapse sort of slack-jawed in front of the television and get my fix.
Yeah.
Fix that way.
I know, it's easy to buy books. I actually just, a very quick story, I just did my tax not long ago, and I was adding up, you know, all the books I buy for research and stuff, and I almost fell over just when I saw the cost added all together.
I caught up what I spent on books. They're best. I just put particularly the stuff for my research, I just sort of put it sort of unseen into my sort of tax box, you know, because that goes against my tax bill, obviously, if it's directly related to my research, and I refuse to look at it and just stick it all in there.
Good idea. I think that's what I'm going to do from now on, not add it up. What's a favourite film? Maybe it might be a history kind of Tudor-related film or anything else.
Well, so again, there's so many. I mean, obviously, because we've been talking Tudors, I mean, I'm sort of thinking of Tudor films. You know, I loved, you know, Anne of a Thousand Days. Oh, yes. And A Man for All Seasons. Yeah, these are great films that one can sit and enjoy any time, you know, preferably on a Sunday afternoon, I think, lying on the sofa. Yeah.
Sounds good. And A Thousand Days, one of my favourites, definitely. So what do you do? You're obviously very busy. You do a lot of, you know, exciting projects and writing projects and talks and all those sorts of things. What do you do to recharge the batteries?
I think seeing friends is the best way to recharge batteries. I recently went, just about a week ago, actually, I went on a walking holiday just for sort of 3 or 4 days with some girlfriends in Switzerland. And, you know, a lot of my other friends laughed and thought this was hilarious, because, you know, they know that I'm physically incredibly sort of idle, and the idea of me going on a walking holiday was so bizarre to them. And indeed, I bought myself a pair of walking boots, you know, leather walking boots, which is a big mistake, because of course I walked 14 miles my first day, which was, I think, you know, a few miles more than I've ever walked before in my life. And God, my toes, I mean, these boots, I did something hideous to my toes, my toenails. I'm really just hoping that I'm going to keep my toenails on my feet. But it was great being with these women those 4 days. It was incredibly good way to relax and unwind and to rediscover, you know, sort of part of oneself, really.
Yeah, that sounds lovely. Very therapeutic, I think. What was your first paid job, Leander?
My first paid job, we're going back a long way there. Before I went to university, I would have done, you know, I did sort of, you know, I think, you know, I did some jobs like sort of shop assistant during the sales. I worked as a jeune fille au pair in Paris. I got on a bus in London to get to Paris. It's the cheapest way to get to Paris. And then I got myself a job as an au pair, to which I was extremely ill-suited, I would say. But I knew nothing at all about children. Those poor children, God, because, you know, not much more than a child myself. But it put a roof over my head and put, you know, a small amount of change in my pocket. So that must have been certainly, you know, shop assistant, au pair. They're probably my very first jobs. I did lots of kind of weird little jobs when I was a student to, you know, keep the wolf from the door. I was a window dresser. I was a sort of clerk. I was a tea lady. I mean, you name it, I've done it.
Excellent. That sounds like you've got some good memories from those jobs. what's something that you're currently looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to, and this is in the immediate future, I'm about to actually go and stay with friends again, just for 4 days with my husband this time, which is going to be great. We've been invited to stay in a villa in Sicily.
Oh, that sounds lovely.
Yeah, so I'm really looking forward to that. Otherwise, one of my sons got married last year. So, and you know, he and his wife have been talking about maybe thinking about having children soon. Wow. So, of course, I can't. Hopefully, they're not listening to this program. But, you know, just between us, you know, I'm sort of slightly sort of thinking, oh, when's that going to happen? It's going to be so exciting. But I have to keep that to myself and to you and your listeners.
Okay, we won't tell anyone, don't worry. We won't let your son know. Now, lucky last question. It's the dinner party question. Now, Leander, if you could invite anyone, they can be dead, alive, doesn't matter. Who would you invite? Maybe what 4 or 5 people would you want to have around your dinner table?
I wouldn't mind meeting Doubting Thomas. He's a character I'd find very interesting, I think. You remember Doubting Thomas, who didn't believe when he re-met Christ after the crucifixion, who he was, and had to check that he was who he said he was. I think the journalist and the historian in me is a bit of a Doubting Thomas. So I am a sort of questioner. I question things all the time, as he did. And yet, you know, he was part of the sort of, you know, the greatest story ever. So that would be pretty fascinating. Gosh, who else would I want to meet? You know, I'm sort of, after that, I'm just sort of, I can't even think. I mean, there's so many people from the Tudor period. It would be quite fascinating in an awful way to meet Henry VIII.
It would be, I think, yeah, that's true.
I mean, it would be quite intimidating, but would be fascinating to see his charm and whether one would see just, you know, how sort of dark and the dark side as well. I think that would be fascinating as well. So I think he would be another character. I've got to have some women, obviously. Currently, I would have to have Henrietta Maria. She had a great sense of humour. She was good company. She would bring the whole party alive. She would cheer up Henry VIII because she was attractive, highly attractive, and quite spunky, and would be happy to answer back. So, and also would have fascinating stories to tell. I'd like to ask her lots of questions. So that's another one. And Jane, I would like to meet Lady Jane Grey. If she, you know, she's been dead however many hundred years, is she still a teenager? How does she reflect back on her life and her choices? Does she see things in shades of grey now that she didn't when she was young and alive? Yes, I think they would be interesting companions. All would be interesting companions.
Yeah, I think that'd be a really interesting night there. I think you might need a glass of wine to accompany your meal, or maybe a couple. That's fantastic. Now, we're up to the very last thing, which is our Tudor takeaway. So this is something for our listeners to go off and check out after the episode. It might be a song to listen to, or something to watch, a book to read. Do you have a Tudor takeaway?
Yes. Well, there's three. One is, and I don't know whether this would be a thing for any of your readers or not, but you can access online for free the calendars of state papers Venetian, which sounds very boring, doesn't it? But you say, oh, that doesn't sound very interesting. But let's say you're fascinated to discover what's happening on X day, or you want some gossip on a particular Tudor figure. Well, you go to, you know, to the year or a date. Or you can type in a name around, you know, a particular period in Tudor history. And these Venetian diplomats, okay, they are the most fantastic gossips, and they send back all these amazing descriptions of people and days and things. And so there's lots of interesting stuff there. And you can just look it up online. Another thing, otherwise, if you want to spend a few quid, not many, I'm sure you can buy secondhand copies, is I think the memoirs of John Gerard, the Jesuit John Gerard, who was a sort of hunted priest. So that's quite exciting, and it's, you know, it's someone who was living during the Elizabethan period. He's describing his time, you know, during the Elizabethan period, being hunted by the authorities, hiding, being captured. I think that would might be something that would interest your listeners, a real voice from the past.
Yes, and I haven't read that, but I've had that recommended to me several times, so I have to get onto it, I think. And I believe there is a copy online that you can read. I'll check that, and if so, I'll add a link for everyone in the show notes. But I think there might be, yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised, Google Books or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, you know, the internet, we can find lots of interesting things on there, can't we? So, Leander, it's been so wonderful chatting with you. Thank you so much for making time to talk to us, especially because I know you're immersed in your research, and so I really appreciate it. So thank you very much for talking, Tudors.
Thank you very much.
Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website www.onthetudortrail.com, where you will also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.